Got a lot of stuff to do here, so let's go ahead and get down. And let's get quiet because the folks on the watching the live meeting can't hear with all the noise going on. The folks on the live meeting really missed out, though. Microsoft went all out for this food. We got caviar and special salmon. The special cheese from France. There was champagne. These $400 bottles of wine. I mean, didn't Microsoft really take care of us? they're on live meeting, right? Hold up your caviar, everyone, right? That'll freak them out. So I got a good question at the break about the have changed, right? We're setting that breakpoint, where you pick the condition, the has changed. What does that trigger off of? Well, what it triggers off of is the first time through, it's basically uninitialized, right? So the first time you hit that location, that's when it's going to save off the value. Then the next time through, it's going to do an apples-to-apples comparison. Right, so the first time through, it never really stops. It's just, through that the second time that it'll get going. Okay, so cool, right? Got to talk about our condition breakpoint, total coolness there. There we kind of did a boatload of these slides, but now you can go back and give this presentation at work and say it was worthwhile to come to because you got all the slides, right? Assertions on the fly, coolness. Ah, okay. Who's doing multi-threaded work? What do you mean you're all not raising your hands? Right? Everybody's doing multi-threaded stuff now. I mean, my God, my mom has a laptop with two cores on it. Okay? So, we're all running multi-threaded. But, there's this really interesting capability in the IDE. How many of you have seen this? Where you're debugging along, your steps have, okay, I'm getting close to the problem, and boom, you're stepping in this thread over here. How many of you have seen that? Okay? What's going on there is there's 30 PhD people on the debugger team. They have their PhDs in artificial intelligence. And what they're doing is they're figuring out when you are within 25 seconds of solving the problem, then they switch away. Okay? And that's why you bounce. Okay? Just kidding. Okay? It almost seems true, though, doesn't it? Right? Because it's always when you get close. What's going on here is that you're single-stepping that thread, but your other threads are still executing, okay? So, we'll talk about some ways to solve that problem, talking about filter breakpoints, right? How do I stop just on this one thread, those kind of things, right? So that's where we have some fun. So first, let me get some breakpoints fired up here, okay? And some threads, excuse me. So we just fired up a bunch of threads. Let's break in the debugger. And go to debug windows, get our beautiful threads window up. And this might look a little bit different to a lot of you because it's been improved dramatically with Dev 10. It's sexier. And it's got a ton of usability stuff in it. You can search in it now, so you can say, hey, show me all the threads that have this in the call stack. I mean, you can filter. You've got a lot better views. You also have the new views for parallel threads, okay? Or parallel stacks, and this will show you what these other threads are doing. Now, this program doesn't do much, but this will show you thread, waiting on thread, waiting on thread, and let you kind of drill down in your threads as well. So they put a lot of thought into how to deal with this. But let's talk about the generalness of debugging multiple threaded programs. So first off, this thread's not doing much. All threads are blocked on this wait right here, just kind of going, hey, let's do something. So if I hit this breakpoint right there, who's going to trigger it? Well, I happen to have five threads down here executing that same spot, so I'm going to stop on all five of them, right? But is that really what I wanted to do? Well, no, I want to filter this down. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to right-click and go to filter, okay? So here's our filter. Whoa, you get the dialog with the most white space of any dialog ever in the world, okay? I guess it's making up for all those German word dialogues that got chopped off, in German, there is no such thing as a short word. I think they'll start at 45 characters. So, this dialogue's making up for it. This dialogue also has another problem. This is a modal dialogue. So if you did not bring the threads window to the foreground before you brought this up, how are you going to know what your thread IDs are in your thread names? Okay? But this filter breakpoint is quite good because you can do it per machine, per process, and per thread. So you can control exactly. And you can see some of the names in there, so I'll do a thread ID. equal. The equal was in the document and it worked. If it didn't work, we killed the debugger team. I'm feeling 6648 is feeling lucky for me. So we'll hit that. There's Switzerland again. There's our filter for that breakpoint. So let's execute through here. And if I did my job, I'm going to signal that event now. If I did my job, we'll stop on 6648. There you go. And that is the active thread. And if you look closely down there, you'll see a yellow arrow on that thread. That's the active thread. Of course, you can double click and change that to active thread, but the little white arrow now shows you, you know, that's the original active thread. Okay? So that's kind of important. So now if I press F5, if I did my job right, we're not going to stop at any other, and there we go. Right? So per thread breakpoints are pretty simple. But let's talk about that artificial intelligence engine that, you know, where you bounce between the threads. What's going on there, really? It's the thread scheduler, folks. Right? You're executing that one thread, and eventually that thread uses its quantum. That's the unit of measure for that time slice that it's been given on the CPU. And what does the thread scheduler do? Thread scheduler says, well, your quantum is up, pulls that thread off that particular CPU. The single step you're doing, that sets a trap flag on the CPU. That's per CPU. Then they put another thread on. That's why it appears you bounce. Okay? So how's the debugger team going to fix this? They could go to the Windows team and say, hey, thread scheduler team, we need a hook in the thread scheduler. And what are the odds of that happening? A negative a billion. Okay? They're not going to put any hook in the thread scheduler, right? That's some of the most critical code in the operating system. So we're kind of stuck. How are we going to keep from bouncing? Right? I just want to finish out this function. Well, let me show you my trick. Okay? So we create some more threads. Okay? And let's break in again. Okay, so I've got some threads here. I forgot to mention thread name. Okay, let me show you something cool. Very good idea. Get in the habit of naming your threads. Okay, if you're creating your own threads, you know, thread X equals new thread, X dot start, right? You're creating your own thread. Name your threads. You can set this name property. Which is easier to set a breakpoint on? Thread ID equal, you know, 6648. Well, that's only for that one instance of the run. It might be a little bit better to do thread name equal quote background printing thread quote, right? So that way you've got, you know, a known value. But naming a thread in .NET, you can only set it once. Because if you try to set it a second time, it throws an invalid operation exception. So that's why I've got the check there. Hey, did anybody set this thread name? You know, do it. Now, you probably don't want to get into naming thread pool threads and all that kind of stuff because they can only be named once. Right? So, what they want you to, what you do in the debugger for thread names is, I'll shift enter, we go here in the threads window, you can right click, and you can rename the thread to Bob. Or whatever you want, you don't have to use Bob. Okay? But if you want to, it's cool. Okay? Because I'm sure any Bobs in here would appreciate it. So, you know, this way you can name the thread. Now you can do thread name equal quote Bob quote, and you'll break. Okay? But that's just for this run.
Rename them again here?
Oh, could we yes. Yeah, that's what I just did, because I was naming them thread, this thread number, and I just renamed them. So basically, this doesn't set it inside the process. This is setting it from the debugger side. And the debugger just puts a smart, basically the debugger only cares about this number here. And so you say thread name equal Bob. They say, hey, is any thread name Bob? Oh, I guess 660. Good enough. Okay. So they'll do the right thing. Well, let's fix this thread bounce around issue, right, where, you know, we're bouncing around. So here's the trick. If thread Bob there is the one I really want to single step, there's actually a wonderful feature in the debugger that's going to let you do that. So what you're going to do is you're going to control click all the other threads except for Bob. Then you're going to right click and say freeze. Notice all the little blue pauses showed up. What does freezing a thread do? Call suspend thread on the thread. Those threads will never execute. Now you can finish single stepping through the end of your function. Okay? So this way, you're not going to bounce when you least expect it, right? You know, that artificial intelligence engine that looks for right when you're close to solving the problem, nah, that's taken care of now. Can you screw up your app with this? Yes. Okay. Okay. So the rule is, right, there's no way to enforce this. Be cognizant of that situation. Yes, I just used it to finish out a function, right? Don't just freeze threads just because you can, okay? You know, I guess if you're paid by the hour, you can right-click on this one, too, and say freeze, and then press F5 and say, yeah, boss, I'm waiting for it to break. You might be there for days for some reason. But you know, if you've frozen the thread, you have to thaw it, okay? So just finish executing the function, then control click all your threads, and right click and use the appropriately named thaw. And I do this all the time, and you know, I'm working on apps that have, you know, 30, 40 threads. Do you really want to control click 29 threads? So I wrote a macro, right? Yeah, I don't do anything but write macros. And they're called freeze thaw threads. And basically what this does is it looks for the active thread, one with the yellow arrow, and it frees all but active threads. That just froze all the other threads. Okay? And thaw frozen threads, boom, that thaws them all. So I just do this from the debugger. So it's, you know, from the macro, so it's real quick. That'll select them all, and then, yeah, I guess you can unclick that way. But hey, I spent 20 minutes automating it.
Yeah.
That's what I started doing. I actually found it a little easier, because then you can map macros to keystrokes, and then you can do it that way, or do it from the command window, right? But yeah, you know, there are different ways of doing it, right? You know, so that's kind of cool. Now, let's talk about another thing with multi-threaded debug. So last summer, I got a fun job. I was working at Symantec, you know, working with the antivirus guys. I mean, man, ninja, right? You know, that's serious stuff, working on antivirus software. And, you know, like most apps, right, these days, they take advantage of all the cores on the CPU. They do their scanning, the pattern matching, and you know, one of the guys at Symantec had a really awesome question. He says, you know what ticks me off about the debugger? I get all these breakpoints set, then all of a sudden, darn, right? I'm stopping on, you know, I got 20 threads, and they're all doing the same kind of thing, you know, because it's all the same stuff, right? Just different patterns they're looking for. I just want to break on this interesting thread, right? You know, just like, only this one transaction going through the, how can I do that? And I kind of went, ooh, that's a darn good question. So I wrote another macro, okay? That's all I do. Called interesting thread, okay? And what the interesting thread set of macros do is set all breakpoints to interesting thread filter. Double click on that. That'll run. And what did that do? All that does is put a filter on all your existing breakpoints to say thread name equal interesting thread. So it just turns all your breakpoints, basically adds a filter to them, so you don't have to do it manually. Then what you do is you say, okay, hey, that's the thread I want to break on. That's the transaction. So you rename the thread to interesting thread. Boom. Now you can follow that one transaction through the system. Okay? And this works great for ASP.NET and all this other stuff. So the guys at Symantec are like, wow, that's really cool. Dude, man, what if I've got two interesting threads? I said, well, I got you covered. Because I will just go down here, right click. Rename, and the debugger lets you set multiple threads to interesting threads. Okay, so now you can follow those two transactions that you care about, because basically all this did was it went to all your breakpoints and set a filter on of thread name equal interesting thread. Right, that simple. Okay, so that's, you know, now we're starting to get someplace. So let me track, you know, this flow through the application. Right, that's smart multi-threaded debugging. Okay. So have fun with that, right? You know, works out pretty well. So there's a filter breakpoint. Okay. Final breakpoint we're going to talk about is the totally cool named trace points. So let's get our trace point up here. Let's clear all the breakpoints. Okay. Press F5. Let's go down and let me get one set here. I will set it there. So a trace point. That comes down if you right-click in the breakpoint and you choose when hit. This comes up here and it allows you to print a message. And, excuse me, you can see that this is a whole bunch of stuff with address, call stacks, you know, so on and so forth. You can even do things like, hey, I want to take a look at my this pointer equal, this equal curly brace, close curly brace. And this will evaluate that variable in that current scope. And what a trace point does, ooh, it's a diamond. 30 artists, okay? Somebody has an iPhone. that's the sound that woke me up this morning. Wait. So what does this trace point do? Okay, let's get my alpha window up. Okay, now if I do my big loop, we see down in the output here,
that basically jammed in the trace statement on the fly, and over
here, there's the values of this pointer. So if you just want a trace statement on the fly, this works great, right? So, you know, just, you know, see what the values are, right, just as your general debugging works fine.
The other thing you can do here, right click,
when hit, you can't execute a macro, okay? But I got to be honest, other than demoing this, I've never done that to solve a bug, right? The macros, are you got to write them in Visual Basic, okay, which is just screwy enough to kind of stop you. That's why nobody writes macros for Visual Studio. Second, macros are really slow, okay? Unfortunately, still in Dev 10, they're still pretty slow. So what happens, you kind of realize very quickly, it's easier just to go add a function to rebuild your app and then just use a conditional. In most cases, that's actually faster, much faster. You know, and then I've played around with some different scenarios, like, you know, the common scenario was, well, yeah, you know, I want to break only when I have 100 items in the call stack, right? I'm doing a lot of recursion. And I set that scenario up, and it actually turned out that writing a function to get the stack trace, you know, you can do stack trace, x equal new stack trace, give yourself a stack trace at any time, and then counting the number of new lines in that string, that was, I think it was about 100,000 times faster than calling a macro. I mean, it was a no-brainer. So, you know, that was the one case where I was thinking, oh, calling a macro from breakpoint would be good, but I just changed the code. It's easier to do that. But, you know, it's there. Knock yourself out. Someday one of us will come up with something cool for that, but, you know, whatever.
You know, just not in my lifetime. Anyway, okay?
So any questions about breakpoints?
Okay.
Good stuff. Hey, there's another iPhone. That's not an iPhone. Okay. Sounded like one. Does anyone actually have Windows phones?
Oh,
wow, man, I'm at Microsoft. I gotta stop that. Man, I'm gonna lose my VDash account.
There's a couple of questions on the live feed.
Okay.
Chuck says, John, I agree with you about IntelliTrace, except it doesn't support 64-bit processes, so I passed on it. Do you know if that's gonna be changed anytime soon?
Okay. Okay, we haven't quite gotten up to the IntelliTrace. IntelliTrace is totally cool. We talked about that at the break. It is the reason for buying the Ultimate Edition of Visual Studio. To give you the quick rundown, I've been watching very carefully how I debug problems. With IntelliTrace, I feel I'm debugging 25% faster. That's
huge, right? You know, especially, you know, with Electric Consulting Company. And if I can debug, do stuff faster for my clients, they're happier.
They give us more money in the long run. So, you know, that's very, very important for folks. Today, running from the debugger does not support 64-bit stuff.
However, what does support 64-bit stuff is if you use MTM, Microsoft Test Manager. That fully supports 64-bit stuff.
They just didn't have time to get the 64-bit IntelliTrace into the debugger. But how do I say this very carefully without breaking any rules? You're going to see it. I'll just leave it at that.
Any new features in 2010 to aid with debugging
.dump file? Absolutely. We're going to cover that. Right? How many of you have suffered through the joy of WinDebug and SOS? Right? My heart goes out. Okay? For most of your dump stuff, right, you just kind of want to get an idea of where things are. And, I mean, using WinDebug, it's about as much fun as hitting yourself in the head with a stick. Okay? It's miserable.
And, you know, trying to use SOS, PSS Core 2, these kind of things are tough, and we're stuck with it.
So what they've improved dramatically in Dev 10 is the ability to open up mini dumps. Okay? Totally awesome. Okay? One caveat. You got to be on .NET 4. Okay? But I find that I'm using SOS and WinDebug a whole lot less because I've got the dump. I just want to see the state of my app. I got this dump off a production box. Hey, what was executed? Right now, I still can't see the memory, right? You know, like what's in Gen 2 and all of that, but I can see the state of the app, call stacks, all of that stuff. So that's drastically improved, okay? And it's great because literally that's gonna cut your WinDebug usage in half, because that's mostly what you did with these dumps anyway. Just open it up in Visual Studio. In fact, we're gonna do that as part of the class here. So there's drastic improvements in that, and it's very good. But the caveat is, gotta be honest, you gotta be using .NET 4 to use that, okay? But you guys are all moving to that tomorrow. Who cares if you're releasing on Wednesday? okay? Any other questions, sir? Okay?
Any questions from the live people? Or your stomach's full from the caviar and you're just getting sleepy now, right? Mm-hmm. Do you need me to turn down the lights and talk in a soft monotone? Would that help? Okay, let's talk about the coolest thing of all, the watch window, right? The watch window is kind of everything that you use to look at variables, right? The autos window, the this window, me, quick watch, any of those windows that let you display the data. You know, the data tips, in fact. Let's take a look at something very cool in the data tips. So let's look at an XML document down here. Let's run this, and let's look at an XML document. So here's our data tips, right? You've all played with these. But, oh, by the way, I forgot to ask a question up front. How many of you have read the Visual Studio documentation for the debugger?
Yeah, normally at this point I get a question. You mean this documentation? So don't feel bad, right? You know, you should. Okay, hint.
But anyway, there's a barely documented trick in these data tips that most people don't realize. Do you see what the problem is with these data tips?
You get it just positioned right and you go, oh, crap, what is the source code doing?
So you got to move back here, click off, and then you're like, okay, how do I get that? Where was I? Right? And it blocks the thing. Here's the thing. Take the index finger of your dominant hand and hold down the control key. 1, 2, 3, down. It goes translucent. Yeah, sexy. Okay, 1, 2, 3, up. Whoa, look at that, right? And it even works fast, okay? In fact, this is the ultimate passive-aggressive tool, right? Because you know how it is your boss wants to be a hands-on manager and like to look over your shoulder, right? You know, if your boss is here, you don't have to shake your head, yes, but we know. But it's really frustrating, right? They're looking over your shoulder. So what you can do is when the boss is looking over the shoulder, you can just do Morse code here saying get, stop looking over my shoulder. I will kill you. I hate you. And your boss is just going to feel, not know what's going on, but they're going to feel vaguely uneasy and just walk away.
Right? So,
you know. But now you never had to say anything to your boss. That's why it's passive aggressive. But these data tips are awesome, right? You know, they're the ultimate watch windows. You can roll the mouse through here. The new thing in Dev 10 is that you can pin the data tips, right? You can pin them down. And you've got a couple different types of pins. You got that location. You've also got a floating pin. So it stays in wherever I scroll in the source code, that stays up, okay? You can pin it to the line, right? That'll pin it directly to the line, you know? You can add comments to it, you know, they've improved. They did a lot of good UI work. But here's something that almost nobody realizes, which I find very frustrating. I'm using the scroll wheel here. There's my inner XML. You can change everything in here. This is all editable. So this isn't a novel, this is reality, okay?
And there, you know, but you can edit everything in these data tips. And that's what catches people by surprise, right?
Then, you know, because people, I've literally watched people get in the data tip, then, you know, literally go to the watch window, type it in just to change this. Well, you don't even have to go type it in. You can just go right click, add the watch. Bing! Did you guys realize there was a right click menu there? Right? A lot of people don't. Okay? So you can right click in the data tip, get to that menu, make things happen.
So, you know, don't be afraid to edit data.
Don't be afraid to play with that, the data tips there. This is all the expression evaluator. That's what's doing all of this work. You just have different ways of accessing it. This expression evaluator is super strong.
Super strong. And you can do some very, very cool things with it. So,
let's look at some of the things that are pretty powerful with it. So I'll set another couple of breakpoints. And, so let's look at something, kind of interesting. Let's do call a bunch, okay? So I'm in this method here, just to show you, okay? And I've got this method called call a bunch method. You can see what it does. It increments the static, and if the static is, you know, divisible by 5, it prints out one string. Otherwise, it prints out another string, right? You know, all I do is write macros and bad code.
But it fits on the screen. You know, like I got to run it 1024 by 768, so that's the limitation.
So here's the cool thing. I can call functions. Hey, they put IntelliSense in here because they want you to do it, right? This is big. So, you know, there's my call a bunch method. How do you call a function? You say, hey, function, or I guess this is a method technically. Okay. And you see the return value? This is the first call of this, so it's 1.
So you can call methods, right? Testing, setup, state.
Don't be afraid to do that. you know, another great reason, right? Certain things don't display well in the watch window. We've all seen this, right? You're clicking, clicking, clicking. You know, pretty soon you expand. I'm up at the wall. I'm in North Georgia. You know, I'm in Tennessee before I ever see the end of these data structures. Wouldn't it be nice to have a method that would just look at the data, you know, that you wrote, that would take the data and dump it out in a much faster, more compact form, like a table? Do that, right? You can call it from here. Also, this is a good thing to do for your assertions on the fly. Maybe you've got something, you know, like once I inherited some code where each node was in two data structures, a binary tree and a doubly linked list. So for the cost of one bug, you screwed up two data structures. Woohoo! So, you know, I wanted a function I could call and say, is this referentially correct on this method? Because we were optimizing it, right? You know, hey, did this thing get screwed up? So we could, you know, call the method directly, see what the state was. Hey, life was good. So there's other places where you can call functions as well. So there's the call a bunch method right from the watch window. You have another window in here with debug windows. Where are we? Immediate. This was put in for the VB developers years ago. Here's a hint. Always start with a question mark here. Question mark is the old VB print. Get in the habit of putting the question mark in there. Why? It helps the IntelliSense. If you don't use the question mark, sometimes the IntelliSense is a little iffy. It's just one of the patterns I've noticed. So just get in that habit. That was quick. Not what I meant to do, but I wanted to show you that IntelliSense was there. Right. Here's your call a bunch method. You know, control space works in here. Enter, open paren. Oh. Do you see something different here? What's different? I stopped at the breakpoint here. So if you call it from the watch window, they disable breakpoints. If you call it from the immediate window, breakpoints remain enabled. Also, calling from the watch window, you have 5 seconds. Right? The function has to execute in 5 seconds. After 5 seconds, they go, whoa. And they shoot that function and reset you. Okay? So if you want to debug, this is awesome, right? Because then you can play around, get state set, you know, single step, right? You know, so I'm single step in the app. And in fact, we can go see this in the call stack window. There's your evaluation of. Total coolness, right? You know, because it's just telling, hey, you're evaluating this. This is what's going on. So don't be afraid to call these functions from these watch windows, immediate windows, and all of those families, right? So now we're right back to where we were. So pretty cool stuff because you can really, okay, let's get my app in the right state that I want. You know, there's calling functions and do it. Use it from the immediate window if you want to single step it. Okay? Now, another thing that's kind of interesting is I changed the way I code to take advantage of this watch window, this expression evaluator, because it's so cool. I never call methods from conditionals, ever. I always put them in a local variable. Why? Because I can go to my watch window, highlight the method, the conditional, drag that down, then drag down the individual pieces and go, what do I do to generate this data to make that? That's the data I need to generate. So I never call methods from conditionals. I put them in local variables so I could play with the locals. And that way I've got control. And, you know, this way I can see exactly what's going on in the app. Oh, this is the data I need to go generate, you know, so on and so forth, right? Also, testing, there's really hard to hit areas. You know, I can pretend that data did come in and see the state of the app. So this really opens up a lot of possibilities. Now, you're looking at this and you're going, wow, John, that's great. That's a static int, right? How many of you are working with static ints every day, right? Just to show you there, it's true. All right, sure, static ints are one thing, but really what are you dealing with? You're dealing with objects, right? You know, how do we change those objects, right? Well, you know, you've all been here. You've all played with this. Here's AE. Drag that down. Okay. And move this up so everybody can see it. Okay. So you've all been there. You've all sat here and you went, oh, wow, that can't be null. Let's say hello to Microsoft's COO. That's Kevin Turner, if you care. You've changed fields, right? Now, you've all done this once or twice. That's easy enough. But man, you know, to debug this scenario fully, I need a whole different object. I need a new object I can set a different state on. So how do you create a new object? Oh, in C#, you do what? New, right? Well, let's try it. I wonder if they want you to do this here. Right? I figure any time a telesense or tool tips come up, that's a big thing. So let's say hi to Steve Ballmer. That's Microsoft Chief Operating Officer, if you didn't know. What does it mean when something turns red in the watch window? It changed. What did we just do? We created a new object on the fly. Okay? And just to prove to you that we did that, there you go. Right? Cool. Right? You know, I don't know what the big excitement is over these dynamic languages. C sharp is dynamic. You just have to be in the debugger, man.
So, you know, this is cool, right?
Because change that object. Make that object what you want it to be. Okay? So this is great for kind of simple things. Yeah, let's just create a new object. You know, it'll set some state. But sometimes you got to do some work on that object to get the state set exactly how you want it. Well, we've got our friend the immediate window. Let's go play around in here a little bit. Let's look at something kind of interesting. We'll say hi to Bill Gates. I think you guys know who he is. What did that just do? I told you C-sharp was dynamic. I just created a new variable on the fly. In fact, here's something pretty interesting. When you create a variable in the watch window, look in the locals window. Does one of these things look different than the other? Okay, so what you're seeing here is that this is the locals window.
They had to stick it someplace. They don't have a globals window. In essence, what we just did, we created a brand new object on the fly, gave it a variable name, so they display it in the locals window because it's in scope, basically. But that's where they'll show it. What does dollar sign mean?
You just read the IL spec or the C-sharp spec. I guess you have a better wife than I do.
Dollar sign means compiler generated variable. Okay? So they put the dollar sign on it. Why? So they don't conflict with an existing X. Okay? So that way you can name it something unique. Now you can go play with this object. You know, and creating it from the immediate window allows you to create it and do more work on it. Then once you have the state set, what are you gonna do? Go over to your AE, wherever you stuck that. Then in the value field, dollar X. What does it mean when something turns red? It changed. Okay? What's the scope? The scope is essentially global. It's kind of funky. Okay? Yes, they show it in the local window, but don't get sidetracked by that. It's essentially global. Because now
you'll see every time we stop, we'll see a dollar X in there.
Until when? Until it gets garbage collected.
Right?
Because it's just created a new object on the fly in the current scope. If we don't assign it to anything, it'll eventually poof, just disappear. That's your sign that it's no longer valid. But we've done an assignment here. So what this originally pointed to is gone. Okay?
So it's pretty cool. I mean, I told you this was dynamic C sharp, right? You know, go off and write your whole app in the immediate window. Okay? Man, that's alpha geek stuff, man, I'm telling you. It's kind of like going to the watch window, right? The watch window has all of this really cool stuff where you can, you know, add numbers together.
You know what another alpha geek thing is? It's to balance your checkbook in the watch window in hex. Okay, that's alpha geek, okay? Used to work with this guy years ago at Numega. I used to work on a product called Soft Ice. Did any of you get to work with Soft Ice? Well, oh, man, my heart goes out. I love you guys. But the chief architect of Soft Ice, this guy named Don Basil, for party tricks, he could multiply arbitrarily long hexadecimal numbers in his head. It was pretty amazing. I mean, we literally were getting up into the multi-billion numbers. He goes, da, 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 da.
We didn't have very good parties. Everybody thought Numega was cool, and we're over there multiplying hex numbers.
But, you know, here's the trick. Create your objects, right? Get dynamic. Really drive. You know, here's something that gets me crazy about, you know, why these people talk about
agile development. They get a little nuts about the testing, right?
Yeah, I'm nuts about test-driven development as well. Come on, folks. Sometimes it's faster to do stuff manually than it is to write some of these tests and MS test and XUnit and all of that stuff. Don't be afraid to write a manual test that says, go in the debugger, go to this method, go drop this in the watch window, you know, go drop this in the immediate window, go do this, go do that. That is so much faster to test than, you know, you sitting there for literally, I've seen people for 3 days trying to automate something that they could do literally in an hour, right? You know, come on. There's a limit. You know, use the debugger, get your job done, move on to other things, okay?
So let's look at another very, very cool thing. And this is something that, a lot of people haven't quite realized the power of, okay? So I'm going to get my doc object up here, okay? There's that doc, okay?
Right, when you right-click here, a menu comes up. The same menu comes up in the watch window, autos window, locals window, right? The same expression evaluator. How many of you didn't know that there was a right-click menu here? Don't feel bad, right? You had to read the doc to figure this out. But or learn the trick that just right-click all over the place in Visual Studio.
How many of you have looked at this make object ID? Okay? It's a very cool thing, right?
So you can go to sleep now, sir, since you know what it is. Most people haven't dealt with this because if you go read the docs for this, which it looks like you did, if you go read the docs for make object ID, it says make object ID puts an ID on the object. Kind of a topology, okay, whatever.
So keep an eye. I can't really zoom in because we're doing the live meeting for those poor folks that couldn't eat the caviar. Keep an eye.
Everybody squint and watch that data tip up there. I'm going to do make object ID. Isn't that so cool? It put curly brace one, octotherp, close curly brace.
That's awesome. And you didn't know that symbol was called octotherp, did you?
Right, Glenn warned you, you were going to learn something important today.
That symbol is actually called an octotherp.
Right? When IBM was designing the push-button phone, some guys at IBM said, oh, we'll name it something funny. We'll call it an octotherp. Obviously, the name didn't stick, but that was the original name that AT&T Labs called that symbol.
Okay? So what does this one octotherp,
I just like saying the name, do for us? Okay? So let's put the doc object down in here. Right? Yep. No big deal. Ooh, get to see the one octotherp again. Well, how about we put one octotherp in there again? Ooh, man. Cool. Okay, let's keep running. Okay. Let's call a bunch. What does it mean when something's grayed out? It's out of scope. What does it mean when something's black? In scope. So what am I watching? I can now watch objects that are in a different scope, a different thread, all of that.
That's what Make Object ID does for you, right? I need to
keep an eye on this thing over here.
Man, you know, I mean, that's a bitch.
Right? You know, without this Make Object ID, you can't watch it. So now you've got a way to observe this, and you can get that right-click, make object ID from the watch window, autos window, quick watch window, data tips, everything. Yes, sir.
Something like closure creates underneath of everything.
What's that?
When you're not creating closure, I mean, you closure create.
Oh, no. This, okay, let me make very clear. This is an observation, okay? This is the debugger observing this object as it goes through the garbage collected heap, okay? It is not a reference. I want to make darn clear, you guys understand it is not adding a reference to anything. It is just observing this object. It's just a feature of the CR debugging API. So there's no reference added here. They're literally, let's just watch this object, right? Yes.
Is there some way to know when this object is valid or not?
Ah, yes. Can you wait about 10, 15 seconds? Okay. Well, maybe not. Let me finish up a couple more things, and I'll show you exactly how to identify is this object valid or not. Okay? So, you know, first off, right, watching outside of scope, okay, that's huge. Okay?
So, let's watch something else here. So I'm going to put the this pointer, another thing about this object ID that's pretty cool. I'll drop the this pointer in here. There's my right click, make object ID. Whoa, two octotherp. Okay?
How do you do a per instance breakpoint? I only want a break when this particular instance is executing through this location.
Well, you could write a conditional if you've got some unique value
in each of your classes. And how many of you have those?
None of you. But let's watch something cool here. Instead of breakpoint, right click, condition, this equal to octotherp. There is your per instance breakpoint. Okay? So I'll press F5, we'll hit a couple of other breakpoints, boom. There's that condition. So make object ID what you observe things outside of scope and what you do per instance breakpoints. Okay. Third thing, to answer your question, that was a little more than 15 seconds, so I owe you. Let's take a look at another scenario here. So this one's a little, I had to contrive this up, but I want to show you exactly your question here, sir. So we've got this code, and I want to show you what happens so you can is this a valid object or not? So, okay. So what I want to do is I want to observe the SB value there, right? So just to,
make object ID. Okay, so I just on the string builder value. On pound, there you go.
We'll execute this, right? You can see it's in scope, it's cool.
Notice it went gray. Okay? Notice next to it, it's got the little recycle button. This is when you call a method. They only call the method once and then gray it out, right? For side effect situations. But here I've got the one octatherp. Let me click the recycle button. What do you think this is telling us? That's how you know it's no longer valid.
This is the only way I know is that in Visual Studio to see if an object has been garbage collected. Okay? That's how you know it's invalid. It got garbage collected.
Because it observes it no matter where it goes in the garbage collected heap, except when it gets garbage collected. So this is huge. In fact, let's talk about memory for a second.
What are the top three things that .NET developers care about?
Salary.
I owe you, Jeremy. I owe you.
I work with Jeremy, and now I'm in trouble.
Well, where's his boss? Memory, not salary, memory. That was good, Jerry. That was good. Memory. What's number two? Memory. What's number three? Memory. In fact, what's number four? Memory. And what's number five? Memory. Number six is hard. Okay.
It's all about the memory, right? All the debugging I do.
Somebody's sitting there going, why is this thing recycling on ASP.NET? Because ASP.NET is only allowed to use 60% of the address space. Why is my app getting out of memory exception? It's all about the memory in .NET. And the garbage collector we've got is the biggest, blackest, darkest, deepest black hole in the universe.
You can't see what's going on in it, right, at all.
So, you know, you need to know, you know, this is why, you know, we spend all our time at Windelec in WindyBug with SOS looking at the heap. That's what you have to look at. You know, to really do all the performance tuning we do at Windelec, it's all memory-based, right? It's all memory-based. So, you know, getting that good feel for when an object got garbage collected is pretty important, right? Because you got to think about it this way. Gen 0 collections happen all the time. Gen 0 collections rarely happen. Gen 2 collections never happen. Seriously, you got to think about it that way. I mean, I've seen big, busy, honking production servers where you maybe have 30 Gen 2 collections an hour. That's forever in computer time. I mean, when the computer is executing in nanosecond time, 30 collections an hour? That's days, right? You know, in nanosecond. That's forever. So, you know, if you push stuff, if you're holding on to stuff and it slides up to Gen 2 and it stays there, then it never gets cleaned up, right? That's why you have these apps that and they go up and they sit in like 600 megabytes. And there's this thrashing like crazy. Right, because of all the page faults, and you know, you've got memory problems, right?
Yeah,
I want to change that AOL thing. You've got memory problems. I want a WindyBug extension that
analyzes the dump and just says that you've got memory problems. You know, I'm going insane.
But you know, this is what it is. So you know, you want to get an idea, you know, at a glance,
what generation is an object in? What am I doing here? What is the state of this app? What is the state of this object? I don't expect it to be set in different ways. You know, where is it? Okay.
So let's take a look at an example here. So we'll run this and do one last little thing here. Let's this. And that's a different doc object. Notice it doesn't have the one octatherp after it. Well, it turns out there's a very cool thing. GC is a wonderful class.
GC dot. Get you all these methods here, and it's got this wonderful method called, ta-da, get generation. Okay?
So since I showed you earlier how you can call stuff from the debugger, SB, that's in Gen 0. It just got allocated. Right?
Now you can look, where is this thing?
So like I can do a GC dot get generation on my this pointer. Okay?
That's Gen 2. Okay. So you can observe, you know, get start getting that feel. Is this thing alive? Is it dead? Why is this thing in Gen 2? Right? That shouldn't be. Right? This is a short-term object, right?
You know, those kind of things. Because the key to any debugging, but .NET debugging in particular, is just getting what is normal. How does your app normally behave? What's your normal memory usage? You guys should all know that, right? You know, just get what is normal so that what? You can tell when you got an outlier. Okay? And because that, you know, so many people, they ask us to debug this stuff, and we ask, what's normal? And they go, we don't know. It's like, oh, God. Okay, we're going to have to spend 2 days trying to figure out what normal is. Right? Then, once we've got that, then we can look at the problem they're talking about to compare that, you know, what is their normal?
And now, of course, their normal could be catastrophic,
right? You just never know. But, you know, we've got, you know, what is normal? When your app is running well and everybody's happy, what's normal? Figure that out, right? Figure out where your objects are. Figure out how, you know, you should all be running perfmon all the time. What number of Gen 0, 1, 2 collections? How much is Gen 0, 1, and 2
heap size? How much is your overall .NET memory usage? How many is your private bytes?
You know, you guys should know that stuff, right? Because if you don't know that, how do you know if you're screwing it up? Okay? So, you know, getting that value. Oh, and the last thing I'll mention about this GC, that get generation, what else works here? Do Octothorpe. So even if it isn't in scope, you can go take a look at it.
So this is pretty cool stuff, right? The fact that you've got, you know, you've got dynamicness because of this expression evaluator.
You've got this very cool ability to take a look at all of these values. So it's very, very cool stuff, right?
There's your what generation the object is in. So
you can go pretty nuts with this, okay? A couple things about watch windows. Okay, just mention them. You've got format specifiers, like you want to see a value hexadecimal because you're feeling hardcore, you can use comma X. Dollar user, very, very good trick. Because dollar user, what does that let you do? That lets you see the security on the process. And if the thread is being impersonated, lets you see
the impersonation security for the account and all of that stuff.
So, you know, just drop dollar user in your watch window if you're doing a lot of ASP.NET, a lot of impersonation. You know, it's very cool. If you turn off the exception assistant, you can look at dollar exception
in the locals window, and that'll show you the current thread's exception
as what it's processing. So anytime you can see that. Okay.
Now, a couple things work pretty nicely. Have you guys noticed
that certain things are more equal than others in the debugger? Okay. So let's take a look at.
So have you noticed that
things like the this pointer? Right there, there's my XML document right there, the one octotherp. Notice that just shows me the type. But you've got the this pointer there, and that shows me a whole lot better information, doesn't it? Okay.
Well, I happen to have this class here called Magic ToString. All it does is override ToString,
and it puts .ctorData equal on the code. So let's go back to our code. So let's go drag this down. What do you see there?
So if you overwrite ToString, you get
this for free, right? How many of you actually overwrite ToString? Okay.
You get it for free, right? It just shows up in the debugger. And this is
C# only, okay? But, you know, just, you know, overwrite ToString, ta-da, you're done, right? But that's C# only. What might be a little bit better for your DB brethren is, let's look at a thing the debugger gives us. It's an attribute
called the debugger display attribute. You really should have one of these
on every single one of your public classes. If you got a public class without a debugger display attribute, I kind of look at that code review and go, what the hell? Right? Because it's always two or three things you got to see in any object, right? Well, make it easy. That's exactly what debugger display does. Quick, which is easier to understand?
Curly brace, complex number curly brace, or 3.4i? I think the 3.4i would win. Okay? And, you know, this is a good example, small class, but still, just having that debugger display attribute there makes huge.
Let's see what my data is. It's always two or three things you got to see. Display the data in a natural form. Either override toString or override debugger display. Now, you can do some more advanced stuff with this, like debugger browsable. I'm just more showing this off than anything. You know, I've got fields here under bar real, but I've got properties down below. And by hiding these, it just shrinks the display a little bit, so I just see the properties. Okay?
So that's another way you can look at it. You know, but most of us now are using, you know, just the auto property stuff, which just takes care of it, right? So we don't even see those fields automatically.
So, you know, this is nice because when you go look at the
complex number class.
So we go execute this,
and there's our 3.4i. And of course, the autos picks it up, everything. What's even better about this is that if you provided the debugger display attribute
on your base class, your derived classes pick it up. Okay, so the debugger's smart enough to go, oh, you don't have one? Let me go up the derivation chain until I find one it has.
And that's what
that's the one that we use. So, you know, get in the habit of doing this, right? You know, make it easy to see the data you need to see, right? Why suffer at it? And, you know, you've got a lot of control over this stuff where, you know, you've got the control to display objects. Now, you can get crazy. Believe it or not, the trigraph operator works.
Wow, that's funky. It doesn't work in VB,
but it works in C#. So, you know, it's kind of wild what you could do. So just stick to reading fields and then calling a property, and that's about it. You know, you can set the name value if you've got key pair kind of situations. And then the debugger browsable. And the result, you know, you get the total view. I'll talk more about this debugger type proxy in a second. But one thing that's kind of interesting is, you know, like the Windows form there, web forms, and a bunch of things have better displays.
So I got to looking at Reflector, and I noticed that there's only two classes in the whole .NET framework that actually use debugger display attributes. And
the Windows forms, web forms, all that stuff don't use it, but yet they've got obviously something going on. So I started doing some reverse engineering. And do you guys know the trick to reverse engineering? The trick to reverse engineering is wandering around the file system. Never know what you're going to find. So, poking around in the Visual Studio 2010 directory, visualizers, and I kind of saw some files in here, AutoEXP, and being an old guy, I kind of went, wow, AutoEXP, ooh, dude,
man, that was AutoEXP.dat in the native days. Right? That was this native file where you could put
extension stuff in to display your C++ types a little bit better, and I went, AutoEXP.cs.
Whoa,
you know, then AutoEXP.dll. So I said, well, this is just a C# file. Let's go take a look at it. And, whoa, look at that.
Do I have the source code?
No. Right? So the debugger's hard-coded the look here and in a global location to say where are the debugger display attributes. And it looks for AutoEXP.dll in those two locations,
and it automatically loads up and knows how to display stuff, and it reloads this DLL every time you debug. So you can add your own to this, knock yourself out, display the stuff you don't
even have source code to, right? And this is where they pick up a bunch of the stuff, right? They're all just assembly-level attributes. The debugger's smart enough to deal with it. That's all that's in this file, right? It's just debugger display attributes. So you can add your own. Okay? So you guys are in luck, because one of the things I did as part of the code download for this little session here is I gave you AutoEXP.cs, my version of it. It doesn't include the standard stuff, but what mine does is that it adds a bunch of stuff I thought was missing. And, you know, I've just, over the years, just keep adding all this stuff in here, right? Anything I found was missing, I just throw it in here. So you can either add, you can add this to your file, or you can create it as part of the full setup, you know, where you can put it in the global location. I'll show you those two directories in a minute. But, you know, simple things like this, right? Have any of you done internationalization work? Right? It's kind of fun, right? And quick, what is 0x409? What locale is that?
Oh, yeah, I have those memorized either.
Wow.
that's EN-US. Wouldn't it be nice to see EN-US or AR, you know, if you're doing Arabic? You know,
you know, why not show the culture info with the display name? You know, things like that. Got a bunch of other ones down here for code analysis rules, because I've written a boatload of code analysis rules over the years. And then finally, Habib Nadarian gave me a pretty cool one here. Here is a really advanced one called this debugger type proxy. This debugger type proxy, this is saying, I've got a class that is so complex, I need you to go create a class in the debugger to display it. Okay? So here's the classic example, a secure string. Because a secure string is stored how in memory? Encoded. So you can't see it, right? So what you can do is that you can say, hey, here's my secure string. Whenever you see a type of secure string debugger, I want you to go instantiate the secure string debugger proxy. And what does that class do? Decodes it. There you go.
So you can actually see your secure string. That's a perfect example. Okay? So, you know, don't be afraid to add your
add this to your source code. If you're using third-party code or some framework, add your own. Now, I do got to give credit. This little application I pulled up here, hey, this is cool, isn't it? This is Notepad 2. I got to give a ton of credit to this guy. It's a free open source Notepad.
Okay? And Florian Ballmer, no, he's not. No relation to a Steve Ballmer that we know.
I checked. But this is kind of a fun. This starts up about 1.5 billion times faster than Visual Studio. And it's got syntax highlighting for just about everything. So if you just need a quick look at a source file, this is it. There's other tools out there like Notepad++. And, you know, there's a ton of them.
This is the one I've always used. And what's fun about this? This is written in straight C.
Hardcore. So like I found a bug in it, so I debugged it.
I sent the guy the patch, and he's like, "Oh, thank you so much. I'm really, oh, this is so great." We talked about some things,
and you can see he's from Switzerland, right? The .ch Confederation Helvetica. That's a Swiss domain. Okay, that's, you know, that's how the Swiss refer to themselves as.
They're advanced. Anyway,
so, you know, I tell you, from Switzerland, I'm like, you know, Florian, I'm going to be in Zurich and Davos in a couple of weeks. I said, I use this Notepad 2 all the time. Let me take you out to dinner. I mean, wherever you want to go. I really don't care about the expense. I literally use this program at least 100 times a day. And you gave it away for free. You gave away the source. I said, that's the least I can do. And he wrote me back. He said, oh, man, unfortunately, I'm going to be in surgery, and I can't make it. And I'm like, oh, man, that sucks, you know. So I'm trying to write this email back going, well, I don't really know this guy. But, you know, it's like, well, I hope you're okay. I hope the surgery goes well and your health is okay. You know, just kind of that Wayne email, not really knowing what to say. He immediately raced me back. He said, oh, no. I'm not going under the knife. I'm the one holding the knife. I'm a brain surgeon. On the list of possible responses, that's not one. Staring at the screen for like a half an hour going, what? You know, and he goes through this whole explanation about, you know, he's got a knife in his hand, cutting somebody's head open. If his hand twitches, somebody dies, right? Or worse, you know, there's a vegetative state. So he's got this whole eating and sleeping and workout pattern. So I was coming right before a surgery, so he couldn't do it. And then I'm sitting there thinking, crap, man. You know, this dude for fun, after cutting people's heads open all day long, goes in his basement and hacks C code. I don't go in my basement and cut people's heads open.
Get the hell out of my field, man.
It's hard enough for me to compete against you young guys. You know, damn, you know? So you can use the brain surgeon's Notepad.
It was just bizarre. So anyway,
so you've got AutoSP, you got the source code for the thing I just showed, okay? Now, talk about these visualizers, right? Everybody's played with visualizers. In fact, you know, the default visualizers are awesome. You play with the custom visualizers as well, right? If you looked at a data set, you've used the new WPF visualizer, Dev 10, you've looked at linked to SQL queries, those are all custom visualizers. You can write your own custom visualizers. It's super simple, okay? So in fact, I'll just pull one up. Just so you can see it. So you guys have the code for this. Like I said, here's the OneLake visualizers, nothing too exciting. So here is the visualizer, what it takes to be a visualizer. Really, really simple.
So let's show you the string visualizer, okay?
So to be a visualizer, brain dead.
You just declare yourself, I'm a visualizer, right? You can have an N number of these things in an assembly,
but you're basically saying, here's the type I visualize. Here's the type debugger I want you to create to go display it. Here's my marshaller. Here's the value I want you to put in the drop-down menu
for this particular type. Okay? Then what do? You derive from this abstract class.
You override a single method called show.
And if any of you have ever done custom marshalling between processes, that's going to make you cry. That's all it takes to get the stuff out of the debuggee. They did all the work for you.
What is the rest of this? Windows Forms.
Okay, you can do WPF too, right? If you've got a custom display, knock yourself out. But here's the thing almost nobody realizes about custom visualizers. The default XML text and HTML visualizers, you can't edit the data.
any custom visualizer, you can edit the data. So when you're looking at that data set in the grid, go change the values. Go put in there what you want to put in. You can do that. So because this is all the visualizer has to do, is just go reach out, hey, is it replaceable? Then you just call replace object, poof, you're done, right? So what does it take to develop one of these? Well, you got to have Visual Studio doing what? Debugging Visual Studio doing what? Well, debugging something, okay? Well, heck, you might as well have the debugger version of Visual Studio debugging the debuggee and have the debuggee debug a debuggee version of Visual Studio. Do you know what happens if you get three Visual Studios lined up like that debugging? You brown out Atlanta, okay? Because it will kill. No, but you know, seriously, are you going to develop a visualizer if you got to have a debugger debugging a debugger debugging something else? Of course not, right? You know, if you've ever worked on add-ins, Vista packages, those are bad enough. But, you know, a debugger debugging a debugger debugging something else isn't going to work. So the debugger team, they said, let's make this really simple. So they gave you this visualizer development host. Literally, writing a visualizer is just writing
WPF for Windows Forms applications. It's that brain dead simple.
It is really simple.
You're just saying, here's my data, go display it. So, you know, if you've got any kind of
interesting display or you wish you could see your data in a different way, go knock yourselves out. You know, you can do that. It's really simple to write these things.
And, you know, I wish more people would take a look at writing these because you don't have to do a lot of work. And the rest of these slides kind of talk, oh, there's the global locations for visualizers
and auto ESP. I said I'd show you where those two belong. So there's, you know, what you got to do, there's basically what I told you. Now, you might be wondering, why did I give you a string visualizer? Well, here's an undocumented hard-coded limit for you. The watch window can only display the first 150 characters.
Okay. So if you need to edit the 152nd character,
well, you open up the text visualizer and you find out, oops, I can't edit the values. So that's why I gave you my own string visualizer so you can edit those long XML strings and stuff.
So there's a bunch of cool free visualizers, you know, regex visualizers. You've got you know, the dynamic IL visualizers, the cache, this wonderful cache visualizer. See your ASP.NET cache as ASP.NET, right? You know, that you can time things out, you know, control it.
This beautiful mole visualizer right up on CodePlex. This was put together originally for WPF. It can handle anything. They did a really great job. Comes with source.
It's awesome. Okay? So you know, grab custom visualizers. See your data the way you need to see it. Works well.
Yes.
Visualizing trying to do multi-targeting, so that the visualizer is not able to target a version of code that's compiled on a different version of .NET framework.
Yeah, you run into that. Take a look at what those guys did in the mole visualizer to do some dynamic loading. To avoid the visualizer writer is going to have to be smart about that. But yeah, you're going to run into some problems because they're kind of reaching in and all the Microsoft ones support multi-targeting, some of the commercial ones, but almost all of these, I think all of these come with source. So you can tweak the source as necessary. I mean, and mainly adding references or removing references that are causing you grief. Okay.
Good question. Any other questions? Hey, speaking of regular expressions, okay.
I get a lot of questions about regular expressions because I've done a bunch over my career.
What's the old story about regular expressions? You have a problem, and you decide to solve it with a regular expression. Now you have two problems, right? You guys have never heard that? That's a good one. But the
thing is that, you know, if you read the Microsoft regular expression documentation, it starts out, regular expressions parse text.
And from that period forward, they assume you're an expert. I mean, really, have you read that? Tried to read the docs for the regex class? I mean, forget it. I mean, there's no intro whatsoever.
So I've run into this a lot, and, you know, we got a few minutes here, so I thought I'd let you guys know there's a couple of great resources for regexes.
So just, you know, since I'm thinking about it, good old Amazon.com is the place to go. Local Seattle company for me, so, you know, help Washington get out of the budget deficit by buying stuff from Amazon. So we appreciate it. So anyway, the Regular Expression Cookbook. This is a fantastic book for starting out, Regular Expression Cookbook by Jan Goviart and Stephen Levithan. This Jan Goviart guy is one of the world's experts in regular expressions.
And this is a very, very good introductory book. Does not make the assumption that you're an expert and really does a pretty good job taking you through, okay,
you know, you got to parse some text. Okay, let's talk about the ramifications and gives you a ton of examples. You know, real world examples, stuff you can steal and tweak a little bit. So that's quite good. So Regular Expression Cookbook and I have no idea what that symbol is, okay? Another one, and this is the one I actually learned from, it's a little more hardcore, actually a lot more hardcore. Mastering Regular Expressions, Third Edition by Jeffrey Friedel. Now, this guy truly is an expert in regular expressions. He spent like 15, 20 years at Yahoo just writing regular expressions. It's pretty bizarre. And, you know, it's this book is a lot more hardcore, but he goes off into...
differentiate between like the Microsoft flavor of the
ball. Yes, they all differentiate. That's the good news. They all tell you some of the gotchas.
And especially this book here.
If you're coming from like Java over or Perl over, this does a very good job. How to translate between .NET and Perl, you know, this kind of stuff. The cookbook is kind of more PC based, right? And so it's a little more towards .NET, the Windows way of doing things. But this goes into a lot of detail. This book goes into like performance tuning regexes. Right, stuff nobody's ever talked about. I mean, really advanced stuff, you know. The kind of thing where you're going, wow, I know this chapter's in English, but like, I can only understand every 10th word, right? You know, it's really intense. But, you know, building regular expressions, you know, you should be writing C-sharp for this. There's a couple of tools, I have them installed. First is RegX Designer.
I might have forgotten to install. I just wiped out my machine and I did forget to install it. I'm sorry. But this RegX Designer is from Cells, so I can't demo it.
CellsBrothers.com/tools. And anyway, this Chris, what did I do wrong? Anyway, go to salesbrothers.com tools, and down here is regexdesigner.net, and this is a great tool because basically you put your regex in here, here's your test text, and you can iteratively build up your regular expression. And so it's free, comes with source, you know, and, you know, this way you can, you know, interactively build up a regular expression.
Now, if you're really serious, and this is free, if you're really serious about regular expressions,
you're going to get this tool I have. It's called RegX Buddy, and I'm not even going to bother to show it to you because it has the surrealist UI approach ever. I think it was written in Alpha Centauri. Okay, it looks like I still have trouble with this UI. However, it has a debugger in it.
And you, if you're doing like
a lot of regular stuff that's going to run a lot on a server, you need to know that you've done an efficient regex. And this is $40. Jan Govier, the guy who wrote Regular Expression Cookbook, this is his tool. This is $40, and do not put a common, called all the time regular expression on a server without seeing exactly how it's going through its pattern matching. Because how many of you have done this where you've written regular expression and you put it in and the program just, you know, it almost dies, right? Because, you know, it's so wild to deal with the pattern matching. And seeing exactly what the pattern matching is doing is awfully important. So I suffered for this tool. I'm not even going to bother to show it to you because it's just too damn weird. Here's a website, regexlive.com. Oh, I guess it came up. I guess I suggested sites are on. So regexlive.com. This is a wiki where people have posted all sorts of different regexes. It's a very, very good list of, you know, all sorts of interesting regexes. So go there first, kind of, you know, great men. What did Picasso say? You know, average artist copy, great artist steal, right? So, you know, you can, get, you know, some regular expressions. And there's a ton up here. There's several thousand. And it's quite good, you know, quite good list. But, you know, like anything else, you get off the web, test it first, make sure it works, you know, does what you want it to do. But I can't, you know, as you can tell, I constantly get these questions on regexes, so thought I would share the answer. So hopefully, you know, it's a little bit better, but the regex there. Any questions up to this point? Okay? Let's talk about some more debugging cool stuff here. Let's talk about set next statement. This is a wonderful little trick. Let's shut down this guy. Wonderful little trick to get total control over your application. So let's look at the coolness of it. And so here is or call a bunch of methods. I want to force this to be true. So what am I going to do? I'm going to grab that yellow arrow and drag it down.
All that does is change the instruction pointer. Doesn't do anything else. Okay? So, you know, in fact, I can get all hardcore with this. Woo! Drag it way down here. The good news in .NET, this is safe enough to do in both debug and release builds from the source code.
.NET always keeps the symbols pretty lined up, both debug and release. So you can do that. Now, if you skip over, all this does is set the instruction pointer. So if you skip over some initialization, what's going to happen? You're going to get the experience, the joy of a null reference exception. Okay? So, you know, be careful, right? You know, you can screw up your app big time with this. Here's the thing a lot of people don't realize about this. You can do more than just go forward. You can go backwards.
Just changing the instruction pointer. Now, if the function is big enough, you can also right-click here, somewhere down here on the world's biggest menu, you will get set next statement. That will move it as well.
Now, the one thing they won't let you do is anything incredibly stupid, which would be right-click here, say, yeah, set next statement. They only let you stay within the function with this. Okay? You guys want to see something undocumented in Windows? Y'all cool for undocumented tricks? This is a message box. You know what you can do in a message box? Control C. Okay? And I'm surprised how many people don't know this, because there you go. I love the OK button.
This works in any application in the world, except if it came from the Office team at Microsoft.
Because Office has this not invented here syndrome, and the regular message box isn't good enough. Okay? And that's where you need it the most, right? Outlook's not deciding it doesn't want to connect. You get these error messages, and you're desperately pressing Control C, and nothing comes out. And you're like, okay, I'm going to drive to Redmond, go to Building 27, and just kill somebody. Okay? You know, because now I've got to go type this thing into the Bing and go find it. Isn't that cool how I said the Microsoft search engine?
Yeah. Extra credit. So, you know, you set next statement. Another cool thing about set next statement
is this. Set a breakpoint. This is the ultimate in getting a data structure set the exact way you want it. So you set your breakpoint, you'll hit it, step over it, set next statement back, change the parameters to the fill method, step over it, set next statement back, step over, set next statement back. You can get the exact data in the exact order that you want, right, just using the debugger to do that.
So that works perfectly fine as well.
All right, let's talk about step over properties and operators. Pretty cool thing in the debugger. The debugger, when you do a step into, what it does is it looks at the method and it does a couple checks. If it is a property or it is an operator and the method has 5 IO instructions or less, the step into turns into a step over, which in most cases is what you want. But if you do want to step into,
you can, where this option is hidden is in the right click. Right, so right click in the source window, that checkbox there, that's what's telling you this guy is, on.
Yeah, because that's the default. Okay.
So that's a good thing. Oh, how many of you have coworkers that write code like this? You have like this, dot A, open paren, then they call B, semicolon C, semicolon D. I hate that. Okay? Because if the instruction pointer is on this line, if you press F11,
which one are you going into? D. Arguments are passed right to left. So you're going to step into D, and
hey, you wanted to go into A. It's like, oh, hell. Okay, let me tell you the deal. If you've got coworkers writing code like this, just fire them, okay?
Come on. Like, why make it hard, you know? I fail code reviews for this crap, you know? I mean, this is horrible. But if you've got idiots that are doing that, or you inherited some code that did that, don't forget about this. Right-click on the line, say step into specific, then this menu will pop out here, and it will show you A, B, C,
and then you can pick the one that you're going to step into.
But just stop, for the love of God, writing code like that, okay? But, you know, some idiots do, so, you know, at least the debugger team is helping us out, okay? So, am I striking a nerve? Yeah.
And when you fire them, say, I
said it was okay. Okay, I'll take the hit. Oh, I hate code like this. Okay, we talked about our threads window, okay, already. But let me show you something cool. The demo gods will work for me here. Let's see if we can get the here. Where are we? Okay. So let's close our thread. And here's the deal. And let's see if I can. Ooh, I'm going to move the cursor. First thing, you see this little this box up here, the show threads and source. Make sure that's depressed, right? Not on Prozac. It's a checked box. Okay. That is off by default. Very frustrating. And you can set this by right clicking in the threads window or in that the debug toolbar. Make sure that is on. I'm going to move the instruction pointer out of the way because it's showing up. Okay. But you see, I'm just going to move it out of the way. Bear with me. You see that I've got the gray background. Okay. And you see in the margin that little threads icon there. If you move that over, that'll show you all the threads that are executing at that location as you're looking at the current thread, okay? So this is a real cool thing, and this is off by default, unfortunately, so make sure that's turned on, okay? Because now we can get an idea, cool, that's what else is executing at this location, so you can look for it. So it's not the ultimate UI that I wanted for multi-threading when I talked to the PCP team, not the drug team, the parallel computing platform team, but, you know,
can you believe they actually named their team PCP? I mean, come on, you know.
Sometimes at Microsoft, you got to wonder. But, you know, it's not the ultimate view, but at least it's helpful, right? You know, this is what else is executing at this location, okay?
And so, you know, always turn that on. It makes your life a whole lot easier. And, you know, so there's a thread. I already kind of demoed this.
We jumped ahead with a freeze thaw thread, right? You saw that. You saw me the interesting threads macro already. To set those breakpoints to stop whenever you wanted to do cool stuff there. Okay?
Now, let's talk about something cool that Microsoft has tried to do for us.
Somebody at Microsoft, I think it's Scott Guthrie's level, decided, you know, come on, everybody's got Reflector. Oh, okay. I'm being told it's a good time for a break. He was seeing the heads bob, right? You know, I was putting you to sleep. So tell you what, we'll take our 10-minute break. We come back. We'll finish up. Microsoft, eat the Microsoft caviar.